Iran's foreign minister says Tehran has responded to Israel right inside Tel Aviv whenever it's decided to. Russia says it's taking control of Ukraine's last stronghold in eastern Luhansk province as a series of deadly blasts hit a Russian city on the border. And North Korea says that the U.S. only wants to attain military supremacy over the Asia-Pacific region by hyping up the threat posed by Pyongyang. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The Syrian president has hailed Iran as part of the solution to problems in the region, and that while he was meeting with Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian in Damascus. Bashar al-Assad said that collective regional efforts are needed to resolve problems in the region, noting that Damascus welcomes any solution that would keep Syria away from war. The Iranian minister also condemned Israeli violations of Syria's territorial integrity. He said the silence of Western countries, which claim to advocate human rights, exposes or double a standard. Regarding Turkey's plan to launch a military operation inside Syria, Amir Abdullahian said that Iran understands Turkey's security concerns, but is opposed to any form of military action in the Arab country.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. They discussed cooperation relations in which Assad described ties between both states as an alliance of will in the face of Western hegemony. During the meeting, the Syrian president touched upon the threats of Turkey to launch a new offensive in Syria. Assad said Turkish pretexts for an aggression on Syria are false, misleading, and disconnected from reality, stressing that they violate the UN Charter and international law. Amir Abdullahian said Assad's recent visit to Tehran constituted a turning point in Syrian-Iranian relations. He added that Israeli attacks on Syria are part of the terrorist war on the country. The top Iranian official noted that Iran is ready to help settle misunderstandings between Damascus and Ankara.
Any foreign intervention in Syria complicates the situation. We understand Turkish concerns over border issues. The solution lies in dialogue between Syrian and Turkish security officials. I understand from my talks with the Turks that they prioritize a political solution.
Amir Abdullahian also had a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. He expressed optimism over solving the Turkish-Syrian conflict peacefully, asserting Iran will exert all efforts to prevent any conflict in Syria. Maqdad welcomed Iran's efforts.
Any solution that leads to Turkey's retreat from Syrian territories, stopping its attacks on the country, and ending Turkey's support to terrorist groups is welcomed. We trust the Islamic Republic of Iran, but not the other side.
Maqdad reiterated Syria's determination to eliminate terrorism and thanked Iran for its support. He stressed that Israel must realize that Syria will not remain silent over Israeli aggressions. The visit shows the depth of ties between the two allies and the crucial role Iran plays in the region, as it comes hours after an Israeli attack on Syria and amid speculations that Turkey is going to launch a military operation in the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
On the sidelines of his visit to Damascus, Iranian foreign minister also sat down with leaders of Palestinian groups based in Syria. There, Hossein Abdullahian emphasized Iran's capability to respond to the Tel Aviv regime inside Tel Aviv.
We have responded to the Zionist regime right inside Tel Aviv whenever we have wanted to.
Amir Abdullahian said that Tel Aviv's allegations that Iran is seeking to target Israeli tourists in Turkey is nothing but a fabricated scenario. He said that Palestine remains the most pressing issue of the Muslim world. He also stressed Iran's unflinching support for Palestinians until the liberation of their homeland and the establishment of the state of Palestine with Al-Quds as its capital. Amir Abdullahian regretted that certain regional states are turning a blind eye to the issue of Palestine and getting closer to Israel to cover up their domestic problems. He said that is a betrayal of the cause of Palestine. Iran's International English Language News Network, Press TV, has celebrated its 15th anniversary. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali tells us more about the history of the news network since its launch in 2007.
To bring you stories that the mainstream media won't tell you.
The Voice of the Voiceless has been its motto since it was launched in 2007. ProsTV now celebrates its 15th birthday.
Well, first of all, I'd like to congratulate all my colleagues here at ProsTV. And this is a really exciting 15 years, I mean, because we've seen so many challenges along the way, so many blocks that have been put in front of us trying to stop us from broadcasting the truth. But fortunately, this is the 15th year, and we will go stronger than ever.
ProsTV's motto arises from the narrative of the Islamic Republic, which seeks to raise the voice of the oppressed, the voice of the voiceless. This policy can attract many audience from around the world.
We search.
We explore.
We discover.
To bring you nothing but authentic news.
Affiliated to the World Service of Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, ProsTV is Iran's only English-language news network, reflecting some of the major developments in the world, round the clock. ProsTV says its major goal is to shine a new light on stories that are either untold, underreported, or misrepresented by mainstream media. A case in point, as put by ProsTV, is the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, where the mainstream have been trying to sanctify the Ukrainian army.
Another thing that people don't realize is that there are crimes that are being committed by Ukraine itself in terms of areas that they are bombarding that has led to civilian deaths. We're not promoting war. Definitely that's not the stance that the Islamic Republic has. But what we want to do is we want to make sure that both sides are relayed in terms of the actual facts, and for it not to be skewed.
To raise the voice of the voiceless, ProsTV has faced many challenges. It was taken off air many times. It was also banned by Google from operating on social media platforms, such as YouTube. In one of the latest measures, the United States Federal Bureau of Investigation seized ProsTV's .com domain in what ProsTV describes as an attempt to pull the plug on the truth.
All of these measures are taken on the part of the West to muzzle the alternative voices and prevent them from reaching the audience. It has turned into a complicated war of narratives, and we have not been passive. We are working to get our message across.
ProsTV, Istanbul.
To unearth the truth, ProsTV has also lost some of its dedicated journalists, namely Serena Shem, Maya Nasser, Habibullah Hosseinzadeh, and Farhad Taqaddusi. Now, as we mark the 15th birthday of ProsTV, we would like to share our happiness with our fellow ProsTV journalists, who are no longer among us.
To challenge the narratives of the mainstream, ProsTV had to swim against the stream. This has not been easy for the past 15 years, but as long as its audiences are growing in number, ProsTV says it will carry on giving voice to the voiceless. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Intense fighting raging in eastern Ukraine, with Russia saying its forces are now in full control of Lysychansk. The city's Ukraine's last remaining stronghold in the Lugansk region. A short while earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry reported its forces were fighting Ukrainian troops inside the city after capturing the surrounding villages. With Lysychansk in their hands, Russian troops would be able to move further into the Donbas region. Just last week, they captured Severodonetsk, another major city in the east. Meantime, in Russia's border city of Belgorod, three people have been killed and several others wounded in several explosions. No reactions from Kiev yet. North Korea is expressing concerns about a U.S., South Korea, and Japan planning to build a military alliance similar to NATO in the region. According to the Foreign Ministry, Washington's allegations about a threat coming from Pyongyang are nothing but an excuse to attain military supremacy over Asia-Pacific. The official says that's why Pyongyang needs to urgently build up its defenses to cope with the rapidly worsening security situation. Leaders of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan met on the sidelines of a NATO summit last week. At that meeting, they pledged to work together on an extended deterrence against North Korea. Time now for the news review program. Lebanon's Hezbollah says its message was delivered to Israel after it launched drones of natural gas filled in the Mediterranean that's at the heart of a dispute with the occupying regime. The resistance movement says that the reconnaissance drones dispatched to the disputed Karish field accomplished their mission. Israel claims it intercepted the aircraft. The regime says it's planning to begin extraction operations in the area. This is despite warnings by Hezbollah and high-ranking Lebanese officials that they would not remain silent. They say the regime's operations are an effort to plunder Lebanese maritime natural gas resources. Let me invite a couple of guests to get some insight from them. Our own correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, is joining me. Also with us will be Said Mohsen Abbad, journalist and political analyst in Islamabad. Mariam, tell us about the stances and position that the Lebanese officials have adopted regarding this latest thing that happened. And of course, we know that, and I remember you reporting on Said Hassan Nasrallah, giving this warning to Israel that we will not remain indifferent.
Yes, definitely. And that, I think, is the biggest card that Lebanon is playing. The Lebanese officials are not standing against the resistance now, as we had, for example, in the past when we had an agreement with Cyprus. At the time, the Prime Minister then, Fuad Sanura, was not seeing eye to eye, did not see eye to eye with the resistance on how to deal with matters like demarcation. Now, President Michel Aoun, who is mainly the main side that's responsible for such issues, is adamant on the fact that Lebanon will regain all its rights. And until negotiations are finalized and the borders are demarcated, the maritime borders are demarcated, then the Israelis have no right in extracting any of the natural resources in that area, which is close to those lines that are still disputed. Now, of course, Nasrallah has claimed that before, that even if the Israelis claim that they are outside of the line 29, which is the main disputed line, where we have the Karish field, which is considered very rich in natural gas, but he also said that Israelis could have also activities beneath the waters, and that is something that Hezbollah will be eyeing very closely. And I think the message of the drones is not only that Hezbollah has the capability to launch reconnaissance activities, but they can also, if they have those drones armed, the Israelis are speculating that Hezbollah has the capability to launch over 100 drones simultaneously and maybe even launch attacks if the Israelis continue with their activities. Now, that is, of course, going alongside the diplomatic efforts of the Lebanese government, which continues its indirect talks with the Israelis through the Americans. And there has been a lot of silence in the talks lately. We don't know where that has reached. Of course, we do have a realistic line, which is line 23, within which there are several fields, but the Karish field lies between 23 and 29. That's something Lebanese negotiators are trying to get from the Israelis, of course. And there is also a lot of speculations from the Israelis on what Hezbollah might do if the Israelis don't stop at the negotiations and wait for the results of the negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of the speculation could be that instead of reconnaissance drones, maybe missiles could be fired. Okay, Mohsen Abbas, as Mariam said, this is a disputed area. So where's the fire? I mean, everybody's keen on getting their hands on those natural resources if that belongs to them. This is what needs to be proven first. So how is Tel Aviv doing this in the midst of such a situation?
Well, when you have a maritime dispute like this, the standard procedure is that actually you settle it through negotiations and through discussions. Israel hasn't settled this through negotiations or discussions, and what they're actually doing is really a part of their wider economic terrorism agenda. They're now adding this, effectively this hijacking of these fields, basically to add to the Lebanese energy crisis. I mean, it's no secret that Lebanon has struggled with energy. I mean, Israel has tried its best to add to that. Of course, the explosion in Beirut and the whole port there going up is allegedly an Israeli Mossad operation. So you can see that along with that and the color revolution agendas, the regime change, the squeeze on energy and the attempts to really create sort of that kind of reaction from the Lebanese people against the government and to create chaos in Lebanon, this fits part of that overall strategy, number one. The second thing is that what's interesting is that Hezbollah has now shown time and time again. They did it first in 2004, November 2004, where they actually launched the unmanned aerial vehicles, the UAVs, or drones, into Israeli airspace for the very first time, and they did it successfully. They followed up in 2004 at Dimona. That was hugely significant because, of course, the Israeli nuclear plant exists at Dimona. This was around October 6, 2012. So you can see there's been a history of Hezbollah also warning Israel that, yes, you want to come and violate our airspace with your F-35s or whatever it is, or these drones that they have, which, don't forget, they use it as an offensive basis to assassinate Hamas and other Palestinian resistance groups on a regular basis. They use their drones in an offensive way. But here, Hezbollah has shown that, look, militarily, we can come and do what we like to your gas fuel, your supposed gas fuel that you're trying to steal, essentially, before any kind of agreements have been made.
Okay, Mariam Saleh in Beirut, Said Mohsen Abbas in Islamabad, thank you so much for your contribution. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. I said that Imam was a fighter. This means that Imam was continuously present in the arena of rising for the cause of God. Imam was truly vigilant about rising for the cause of God. The establishment of the truth and justice was naturally Imam's goal. Well, how can this goal be realized? The establishment of the truth and justice was Imam's goal. But is it possible to establish the truth under the hideous roof of the Pahlavi regime and every other dependent regime? Naturally, no. So the next goal is to bring down this roof. Therefore, Imam tried to remove the hideous roof of the Pahlavi regime for the nation and lay the groundwork for their movement, their uprising and their progress. Let us split open the roof of the sky and lay out a new design. This is a poem by Hafiz, the Persian poet. This included both a rejection and an establishment.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
First, the rejection of the Taghuti regime, and then the establishment of a desirable political system which could move the people forward. This was Imam's movement in the area of rejection and establishment. There were a number of outstanding points in the movement of Imam. First of all, there was no fear in him. He did not use to fear and flatter. He was outspoken and had an eloquent tongue. This dates back to the revolutionary era in Qom and Najaf. He would speak to the people and would constantly explain and guide. His tongue was truly a decisive dhulfiqar with which he would move things forward. He was outspoken. He trusted the people. One of the most important qualities of Imam was his trust in the people from the first day. There were people who wanted to fight, but who said that the people would not follow them? However, Imam believed from the first day that if we entered the arena, the people would follow.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil
and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over a million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth to kill, thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital Madrid to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliament and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit. And this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities, claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Both Russia and China have reacted angrily to the accusations and threats directed against them by the NATO. Beijing has slammed NATO's warning as completely futile. In their recent gathering, NATO leaders said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties to Russia pose a challenge to the interests and security of the military alliance. China has accused the alliance of, quote, maliciously attacking and smearing the country. Its mission to the European Union said NATO claims that other countries pose challenges, but it is NATO that is creating problems around the world. The confrontational rhetoric comes as the U.S. is stepping up efforts to increase its military presence in Europe.
Apparently, the assumption is that with more Western weapons coming to Ukraine, with more military assistance reaching Kyiv, with more exhaustion on the Russian side, the course of the military conflict might shift in Ukraine's favor, and that with time, Ukraine's negotiating positions might get stronger.
U.S. President Joe Biden pledged more American troops, warplanes, and warships for Europe. The U.S. has pledged over $5 billion in U.S. aid, yet Ukraine is losing the war. It is now believed the U.S. and Western allies are deliberately protracting the war to station more weapons and troops across Europe and militarize the public discourse.
The United States is drumming up support from regional nations in East and West Asia to unite under alliances against Washington's perceived threats. According to a Wall Street Journal report, the U.S. held secret meetings with senior Israeli and Arab military figures, namely from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Jordan, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain at the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh in March. The talks were focused on Iran. Washington has been mulling the idea of forming a regional alliance against Tehran by bringing those with strained relations with Iran closer to Israel for quite some time now. The Abraham Accords, under which several Arab nations normalized their ties with Israel, is widely believed to have been part of the plan. This is while Iran is taking diplomatic steps to strengthen ties with its regional neighbors, which may include some of the very nations that are being considered by Washington as potential anti-Tehran allies. The Islamic Republic and Saudi Arabia have been engaged in talks aimed at the normalization of their bilateral relations over the past few months. Iranian and Emirati officials have also expressed willingness to restore warmer ties in recent months.
What we can observe is the world as a whole is moving towards a more multipolar world where countries are not afraid to be in relationship with one another despite U.S. interests. And we see this happening all throughout the world. And we can simply look to a summit of the Americas that was a failed attempt at the U.S. to kind of bully itself into remaining and enforcing its U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world. And so with recent events that have been happening around the world, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the U.S. trying to again impose U.S. hegemony in other places throughout the world, we see countries moving further and further away from U.S. interests and really focusing on building with one another in the best interests of their own countries.
That poses some serious questions about the effectiveness of a potential U.S.-backed regional anti-Iran coalition. North Korea has accused the United States of trying to set up a NATO-style military alliance in Asia, saying Washington continues to hold military maneuvers with East Asian states despite Pyongyang's warnings. In a statement posted on its official website on Sunday, North Korea's foreign ministry said Washington is making a, quote, full-fledged move to establish an Asia-style NATO while blatantly holding joint military exercises with Japan and South Korea. The remarks come on the heels of recent joint exercises by the U.S., South Korean, and Japanese forces, which involved a U.S. aircraft carrier for the first time in more than 4 years. In a meeting after the drills, North Korean officials condemned aggressive moves by Washington and Seoul, pledging to take revenge on the U.S. imperialists as they mark the 72nd anniversary of the outbreak of the Korean War. Why is it that Washington prefers setting up military deterrence when it can resolve conflicts through diplomatic means? Wouldn't that be a less costly and more efficient way of diffusing tensions?
We live in a world where, with all the nuances in North Korea, with all the misinformation that we are told about North Korea, the U.S. is trying to create fear without actual evidence. So what we can expect in upcoming months is that the U.S. is going to try to make it seem as if North Korea is the aggressor, as if they are not doing military exercises right outside of North Korea's borders, to provoke and to create the conditions to justify military actions and military exercises against the people in North Korea that have chosen to continue to build their country in favor of a one Korea and reuniting their countries and moving away from U.S. Interests.
The history of U.S.-led alliances, including that of NATO, shows that more often than not, they fail to accomplish their self-declared objectives. It wouldn't come as a surprise if newer ones won't have a different fate.
Strikes in Europe's transport sector have disrupted air flights and train schedules as transportation companies struggle to cope with rising demand at the start of the peak of summer travel season after COVID restrictions were lifted. A strike by staff members at Irish Airline, Ryanair, and Brussels Airlines over pay and working conditions forced the cancellation of many flights. The workers' strike also disrupted flight schedules in Spain, Italy, France, Portugal, and Belgium. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the British railway system once again came to a halt. Tens of thousands of workers have walked in Britain's biggest rail strike in 30 years, with millions of passengers facing days of chaos as both the unions and the government have stuck to their guns in a row over pay. The British Transport Union, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers, RMT, threatened to continue the industrial action until managers address the workers' grievances and meet their salary demands. According to the UK government career service, RMT members who are not high earners, for example train guards and track maintenance staff, earn somewhere between £20,000 to £35,000. But the union says its members deserve more. Despite the ongoing negotiations between representatives from the management and staff, the media predicted the strikes to continue. They attributed further industrial action to the rapidly rising inflation rates exacerbated by sluggish economic growth, saying this combo will likely lead to more worker strikes across the European continent in the summer ahead.
The people who are on strike have been pretty clear about it, including in Great Britain with the railroads, the airline pilots, and everybody else. For some years, they've been in trouble and there have been increasing social unrest. And what's happening now is a huge increase in inflation and hence a decrease in purchasing power, and people's standard of living is going down. And so you're having a confluence of events. You have this economic crisis, then you have this people saying, listen, we cannot let the war in Ukraine completely derail the environmental crisis. And furthermore, the policies, as another group saying, look, the policies that we're pursuing, that our governments are pursuing in Ukraine, are adding to the problem not making it better.
Unions have said the rail strikes could mark the start of a summer of discontent, with teachers, medics, and even waste disposal workers heading for industrial action as inflation pushes 10%. Inflation has soared across Europe on the back of a major rise in energy costs, and Britain is not alone in facing strikes. Russia's war in Ukraine pushed the already rising inflation in countries that use the euro to a record high in May, with energy projected to have the steepest annual rate. As the war in Ukraine drags on through its fourth month, the West, led by US and NATO, remains largely united in backing Kiev, but they are divided over how long they're willing to endure the conflict's economic fallout. The prospect of a drawn-out conflict with the battle raging in eastern Ukraine has raised questions about whether war fatigue, coupled with skyrocketing food prices and energy bills, could test countries' political will to keep pressuring Moscow over time. In the U.S., President Joe Biden blamed the Russians for rising U.S. gas prices, saying it was outrageous what the war in Ukraine is causing. Hungary, on the other hand, has called for immediate peace talks to end the war between Ukraine and Russia, warning that a prolonged conflict will fuel an economic crisis that will imperil governments across Europe. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned of an unprecedented global hunger crisis in light of the recent developments.
There's a couple of different things going on here. There is the United States as an outlier in NATO in a certain sense, with some of the Eastern European companies really pushing for more and more aggressive behavior by NATO in Ukraine. You have other countries which are in Western Europe who are suffering from the United States activities here, the real pressure economically, and are beginning to say, wait a minute, this is not what we really want to have here. Our population's getting upset. And then you have apparently the failure of the sanctions. And in the United States press, at least, the understanding that maybe they're not going to work so well. And so the Russians are not going to be suffering so much.
Western countries rallied around Kiev when Russia began its military operation in Ukraine in February. But now that unity is being tested as soaring inflation and energy shortages rebound on their own citizens.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum everyone. Welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic belief, in which you'll get the answers to all your questions. So let's start, but before that, I'd like our guest to introduce himself to us.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Sheikh Noor Muhammad. I'm very happy to be here.
And I'm very glad to meet you here. There is another question which is regarded to be related to hijab or whatever we could see in different countries that would differ from one country to another, whether it be chador or scarves or a special sort of veils or dressing, whatever it would be. But it seems to have been bothered many of people all around the world. And we could see that European countries are making some laws to ban hijab. And if you have a scarf or a sort of special coverings, you're not allowed to go to universities or perhaps participate in different sorts of areas in society. So is it dangerous? Is hijab starting to be dangerous to some people?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, I'm not sure whether many countries are fighting with this hijab or they disagree with the concept of hijab or not. We have in some certain countries that unfortunately, for example, in France or at least in some parts of that country or in some European country, and recently, unfortunately, in some other countries, the fighting and say have some disagreement with the concept of hijab. I want to say that, it is not in according to the freedom of thought and freedom of speech. You know, I'm really wondering why these guys, the politicians are fighting and they have some disagreement with the concept of hijab, while in the same time they have the very, heavy propaganda and a slogan that we are supporting the
freedom, free wills, yes,
freedom of religions. We have the liberal country. We are free.
Human rights, of course.
Yeah, and human rights. Yeah, and foremost and the beginning, we have the human rights and the freedom of speech, freedom of religions. We have heard a lot of these kind of slogans from some European countries and from some Westerners. On the other hand, we have these fights, or some disagreement with the concept of hijab. I don't know how can we have these, double standard with the some of these European or Western countries. On the other hand, that...
So, to make it very much clear, why they have problem with hijab?
I don't know.
At the first hand.
I cannot understand that. You should ask them. Because it is not in according to their own standard of thinking. Mm-hmm. It is not in according to their, propaganda. It is not in accordance to the, human rights.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I want to choose, this is my choice. I want to choose to be a Muslim woman or a Muslim man. I want to have this chador, I want to have this hijab. Very beautiful styling, the style, as you mentioned in the beginning of your question, styles are different. In some country they have chosen, this part or this color.
Exactly, colors are different, the coverings are different.
Yeah, colors of different, styles of different. But after all, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in two verses of the Noble Quran talks about the concept of hijab is, it is a standard that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentioned it in the verse of Noble Quran. What Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentioned it in the verse of Noble Quran is a criterion, but it can manifest itself in different styles and colors and in different cultures, I want to say that you should ask themselves why they're fighting and they have some disagreements.
To some points, it would help the growth of Islam, maybe.
Of course, we have some, assumption. For that, because if you have your personal religion, you go to your house and start praying individually,
mm-hmm.
or you may fast Okay.
Yes.
Maybe nobody has any problem with you.
Because it's something personal. Nobody is going to get affected by whatever you're doing.
It is personal. It has nothing to do with the society.
Yes.
And it has no manifestation, you know, beside
yes,
that.
Yes, yes.
But in a way that once you want to have this societal manifestation of your religion.
Once you come to practice it in the face
publicly,
of other people,
yeah,
it becomes a problem.
It becomes a problem. And it is exactly the point that we have it in the, you know, philosophy of Imam Khomeini. Okay? If you
yes.
look at the writings and the books of Imam Khomeini, you can find some very interesting ideas about societal aspect of Islam. Okay.
Yes.
Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul, he started to elaborate on societal aspect of Islam, and he, you know, expanded on this idea that Islam is not only personal religion, rather it is political, societal religion. And the political,
it has got different dimensions.
Yeah, and political and societal, this you know, dimension of Islam is maybe to some extent more than the personal aspect of that.
Exactly.
If you go to the book of Wilayat al-Faqih or Kitab al-Bay or Kitab al-Darar or many other, you know, books of Imam Khomeini, you can find it very interesting how Imam Khomeini, and of course not only him,
mm-hmm.
of course many other scholars beside him, of course I do not want to mention their name,
yes,
they expanded on this issue that Islam is not only personal religion, rather it has some political and public, you know, or societal mm-hmm. aspect attached to that. And very interestingly, Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul, he said that even your personal prayer, it is not, you know, I mean, even your individual prayer, it is not personal.
Exactly.
You know?
We have it in our du'as. We could see that. It is not personal. You're not just praying for your own self. You pray for the society. You pray for other people of your nation.
Exactly.
Or of the world.
Even, for example, your, you know, namaz or salat, okay?
Exactly.
It is individual. Maybe you, you know, done it, you, it is allowed to do it in your house, okay, in your home. But, you know, it has some societal aspect attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, your prayer, it is very much recommended to be, you know, in congregation,
mm-hmm.
okay? And of course, aqimu salat, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in the verse of Noble Quran. Of course, I do not want to go to
yes,
that.
Yes, just in order not to get deviated from the main point that
yeah.
we were talking about. We were talking about hijab and why the European countries are putting the pressure and the stress much more stronger on people who are practicing hijab.
The point that I want to make it here, and of course I mentioned so far as an introduction, you know that when you want to manifest societal aspect of Islamic laws,
mm-hmm.
in that time it caused some problem for people and they cannot
uh-huh,
understand
that's
it.
That's the point, yes.
It is a point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that when you have your individual prayer, maybe, or for example, you have your fasting, nobody has any disagreement with that. But in once you want to start indicate it to the society
mm-hmm.
and to show your you know,
you show your side.
Yes, your societal aspect of your religion. In that case, unfortunately, many people maybe they cannot stand it.
Exactly, it becomes a problem.
Yes.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Insha'Allah, 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 you'll find your way.
So, as just we talked about hijab and we said that in many countries, women have been banned from having hijab. And even if there is no law for that, you could see that when people are looking at you, it's as if they've seen something very strange and they give you the impression that you're not welcome to that society or to that, I don't know, you go to library, you go to store, to wherever. Just as you are practicing hijab, it feels like you're a stranger. That's the point that I was mentioning. It's not about law. They are making a propaganda against that. And it seems that it has started to make some problems for them.
We have, of course, in any country that you may visit, you can find some people.
Yes.
They are looking in a weird way. You can find. But on the other hand, many people are welcoming.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Because it is my choice.
Everything has changed, of course.
You know?
And the world is changing.
Yes,
it's very
of course they understand. Understand that, for example, even in any other country, you have some Buddhist, you have Christian, you have mm-hmm. Jewish people, and of course you have Muslim.
Exactly.
And I want to have this is my religion, and I want to keep it, and this is my identity. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that
people of different countries usually don't have problem. It's the government who are making the problem. People usually have this understanding with each other, with different religion, with different nationalities. They do not have these sort of problems with each other, as we could see in different societies.
Of course.
It's the government who imposed those disputes and struggles in between people.
Talking about the government, maybe, as I mentioned, it is a societal aspect of your religion. And what is an indication of that? Your hijab, maybe it is an indication for your disagreement with injustice.
Exactly.
Because you are the representative of the story of Karbala, maybe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to show that I'm following Lady Zainab. I disagree with some injustice. I disagree with tyranny and many other operation around the world.
Exactly.
And because of that, maybe some governments they still have some fight and disagreement with the concept of hijab. But I cannot come to a clear understanding that why these guys they have some disagreement or fighting this childish disagreement and fighting with the concept of hijab. I cannot have the clear understanding that even if, because if this is my personal choice, I want to have it.
It's my body, and I have chosen this style of living for my body.
Beside many other religion that we have, this is my religion, and this is my identity.
Exactly.
I want to have it. It is not,
no matter how much pressure you're going
your
to
concern.
Push on me.
It is not none of your business,
mm-hmm.
okay? Why you have some disagreement with the concept of hijab or many other concepts? But I mentioned that these are some of the maybe philosophy or excuses that some people they have some fight with the concept of hijab. I want to say that we cannot say that this is my. I want to say whatever choice that you have, it must to have some kind of rational supporting
mm-hmm.
or rational backing.
Yes.
The concept of hijab that I have, it has a strong rational backing. Okay.
Exactly.
Because I want to have immunity from the ill, people. Those people who have some ill looking at me, I do not want
from
to be...
From sick hearts.
Yeah, for the sick heart as a... verses of Noble Quran mentioned, I want to be servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I want people to look at my personality, okay? Not
yes.
to look at my beauty. I want to have my beauty within
and
my
and not to have a physical
yeah.
look at you.
I do not want people to misuse me,
exactly.
to misuse my, beauties. These are very understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And, palpable reasoning behind the concept of hijab. And many people, they understand that. On the other hand, when you do not, have the concept of hijab, many people, unfortunately, many entrepreneurs, they misuse you for the cheap paying.
They enslave you, yes. That's
yeah, we
true.
Have the, this modern slavery.
Exactly.
And because of that, maybe some people, they have some disagreement with the concept of a hijab. But after all, I, invite these people to have some dialogue, This
mm-hmm.
is maybe the best way to come to a clear solution, to have our dialogue.
Exactly.
Come to their, we can have, via some social media, we can easily talk to each other.
It's a modern age. We could have some logical discussions.
Why you do not talk to each other? Why you do not have...